Good evening and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which is on a mission to make America think again. We're not going to tell you how to feel. We're not going to tell you who to vote for. We're just going to bring on the experts who are working behind the scenes to make America great as it has always been great and to keep it great, because it's what's in the shadows that makes the world go round. And tonight, excuse me, we have a very special guest who's been with us several times before. He's just an amazing person, Admiral Joe Sestak. Admiral Sestak was a three-star admiral. He was a presidential candidate. He was in the Navy for 31 years as the highest-ranking military officer ever elected to Congress. He was a congressman. He has a PhD. The man has done it all. And he's nice enough to be here with me and my wonderful co-host, Liberty Jones. So welcome, Liberty, and welcome, Admiral Sestak. Thanks so much for coming back to the show.
It's great to be aboard with both of you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Let me start with what's going on in the Caribbean, Admiral. The buildup of ships in the Caribbean. We've sent a carrier group, I understand, to the Caribbean. You used to be in charge of a carrier group. Is aircraft carriers are pretty intimidating, are they not, Admiral? Is that the purpose of sending it there, to intimidate, or do you think that we're ready for a confrontation?
It's at least a signal that this president is trying to say, I'm pretty serious about this, but I think the signal really isn't to the drug runners. I actually think the signal is the president of Venezuela, Mr. Maduro. But is it a powerful unit? It is the most powerful, mobile, together, instantaneously useful, can reach anywhere in the world with some refueling into the center of any country that we have in the United States, including the capability for nuclear weapons. And yes, it is quite powerful. But again, I just want to point out the reason is are enlisted. And I say that because on that aircraft carrier, there's 5,000 sailors. Their average age is 19 and a half, and they run a nuclear reactor. They launch your plane when you take off. There's no one better than them. As the commander-in-chief of the Soviet Union said, when he came over here during the Gorbachev era and visited all America, aircraft carriers, malls, went to an Arkansas barbecue with our chairman, Admiral Crowe. And when the commander-in-chief, head of the Soviet Union's army, flew off, and military, all military, Admiral Crowe said to him, what is it that most impressed you this past week in America? And he turned and he looked at him and said, you're enlisted. We don't have them. And you could see that when they went into Ukraine, and an army one-third the size stopped them in their tracks.
Yeah. Well, and let me tell you, I was a truck driver years ago. I lied about my age at 17, and I became a Teamster truck driver, which you could do in those days years ago. And I was in Baltimore one day making a delivery in the harbor, and there was an aircraft carrier. I think it was the John F. Kennedy. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't even docked. It was out in the harbor. And I've never seen anything that massive in my entire life. You know, I've seen plenty. I know everybody's seen them on TV and we've seen them in movies. But when you're up close, man, it is just, an amazing sight. It's an amazing sight.
Yes, it is.
Liberty, is there something you want to add?
thank you so much for being on the show today, first of all.
Thank you.
I don't have a particular question about this, but I wanted to understand kind of in the same ballpark. You know, you're someone who has commanded a lot of different forces globally, and you've had the power to take one of those massive, you know, I guess weapons of war, and not weapon, but form of transportation, and understood what is the best way to go about controlling that. I don't know what I would do. I don't know the first thing about something like that, but I think it's beautiful. And so I want to understand that side more. You know, what signals a deployment of that scale? And what typically is it for allies? Is it for adversaries? Like, what to you would be a situation, especially right now with our foreign policy, where we would actually be able to employ something like that?
Well, first of all, the Navy has, since World War II, kept about a third, a little less than a third of its force, always overseas. We call it forward presence. To the senator's point, it's a signal. It's meant to be a deterrence. Now, we are out here showing our determination that our interest and that of our allies will be protected. Because after World War II, Liberty, as you well know, America's greatest power has been to bring allies and friends together, to convene the world, to protect interests, to further interests that is a common interest of all of us. We built a world order based upon universal values, democratic values. And because of that, and because of our allies, and being forward to show our determination that we will protect what we need to, we won the Third World War, the Cold War, without firing a shot against the adversary of the Soviet Union. Our major issue with our military is to deter, because people need to understand, like they didn't for the tragic misadventure in Iraq, that militaries can stop a problem. We don't fix them. I doubt very many people today think we fixed Iraq. We may have stopped Saddam Hussein, but when we removed him, it took away the blocking back who kept Iran fixed in place, fighting them that they couldn't do mischief of terrorism throughout the Gulf. It also then created ISIS, which is now metastasized through the Middle East down to Africa. In short, if you're going to use our military, and if that's what President Trump is thinking about in Venezuela, you better know how it's going to end before you begin. But I also am so glad you brought up, Liberty, because today it is vital that the word you brought up is thought about, allies. We have to remember, take Ukraine. They sent 8,000 troops to a war that wasn't their war, Iraq, because we asked them to. Take Vietnam, because we had convened the world. 320,000 South Korean combatant soldiers came there to help us, as well as scores of other nations. 58 in Iraq. When I arrived, my Karabata group in the northern Indian Ocean, I had the most powerful mobile unit in our nation's military arsenal. But when I arrived, there was with my 12 ships, nuclear submarines included. But when I arrived there, there was a larger armada of 22 ships waiting for us. We had Japan there, outside of the Sea of Japan, for the first time since World War II, because wow. America had asked. We had the Australians there, of course. We had Greece there. We had Spain there. We had them all were there. Poland was there. And the Italians hadn't quite arrived yet. And as its ship set sail to join us, with a bit of military humor, which Al General Powell said is the great force multiplier in the military, the Italian Minister of Defense sent a message that said, many people may look at us Italians as primary lovers, but America yes. has been attacked, and we will be there for them. Today, we are squandering what our forefathers built by not respecting and building up those allies and friends that are so required today for a challenge we have with an authoritarian world order under China and somewhat with Russia that they assembled last summer all together. They convened 50% of humanity on this earth represented, along with 36% of the GDP on this earth represented under their aegis at what's called the BRICS conference. I bring that up because that is our major challenge today, how to deter so that Taiwan or other efforts don't break out in conflict. And that's why our Navy is forward deployed and forward based with a carrier battle group in Japan, as well as ships rotating at all times based in Guam And we're moving 3 destroyers, brand new ones, that will carry hydrosonic missiles to Hawaii to be more forward deployed, to make sure that people know we will protect the interests of our allies, friends, and us.
Well, let me ask you, Admiral, given what you've just said, this is all seems so complex. How do we connect the dots for people? Do you have any idea on that? Because I think the average American buys these sound bites where we say we're killing these people. We've murdered 83 Venezuelans, by the way, so far, that we're killing these people because they're drug dealers, and we're really not doing any kind of damage to our world image. We're really not doing any. They don't focus on anything beyond the immediate soundbite. How can we get people to understand that we're all interconnected here, and that this is not just about a single activity or a single episode, but it's woven into our international strategy?
I think that's unfortunate, but those who had a common story that bound us, helped bind us together with allies and friends, was the world's greatest generation, those that fought World War II. When the men came home, 18 million men had joined up in the military to go. But they had emptied the factories and the farmland. And so Rosie the Riveter had to man the factories, including the new factories, to build the armament, as well as the farmlands, as Jeannie, the farm young woman had to take over. We had universal child care for the only time in America during World War II. So the women built the armament so the men could use, so that when they came home, they both had done service to our nation and won. That remembrance of allies and friends, what it meant to be alongside Great Britain, what it meant to have Australians there, where even when I went there in the 80s or early 90s, I couldn't buy a drink in Australia. They loved us so much, as long as I was in uniform. So I think we've lost that generation that's told stories. And to some extent, war recedes in the background, as World War I did for those who went to World War II. And when you begin saying that they are taking advantage of us, our allies, my gosh, the most precious asset, as I said at the beginning of when we spoke in our U.S. military, are our enlisted and officers, people willing to die for their country. And that is what they gave us when we called and said, 9/11 has occurred. Can you join us? The next day after it happened, NATO evoked the article that said, we will defend America and go to war unanimously. And they all came. They gave us their most precious resource. So I bring this up that I think to some degree, not having presidents that have served of some length of time since George Bush, G.W. Bush, a man who jumped out of a burning helicopter, a man that worked in CIA, a man that worked actually and could speak to it and represented it. Some of that I think we lack, particularly when certain statements are made by presidents that really, I believe, put down or don't understand what we really bring to this nation, which is, yes, winning wars, but also following the law. And to one of the reasons you asked me to come on board tonight is what you mentioned, our Caribbean operations. And is what we've done there a lawful order to strike narco traffickers? And I'm happy to speak about that now if you'd like.
Yeah, I really would. And I'd like to, because, I find it very, very concerning that the President of the United States has called veterans like Senator Kelly seditious and treasonous and suggested that they should be hung. One thing that I know about military people, admirals, my brother was an Air Force pilot. I've known a lot of military people in my life. And one thing I know about them is they're really honorable people. they're when you're around them, their honor and their dedication to our country is palpable. You really feel it. And so, yeah, I'd love for you to talk to that, because I think that is the most horrible thing I've ever heard in 40 years of politics, that man put out on Truth Social that these people should be punished by hanging.
Yes. So to first speak about the law and the illegality of the orders, I'd like to speak a moment about the facts, because I think the motto of our government should be, in God we trust, all others bring data. And the data here shows that the law says that if you want to designate someone as a foreign terrorist organization, like we did Al-Qaeda, like we've done to ISIS, that puts them into a situation where it is called a non-international armed conflict, and they are deemed hostile as soon as you give them that FTO, Foreign Terrorist Organization. But to be deemed that they are an FTO, like Al-Qaeda, they must show by the law that these Congress members are responsible for making, and what it says is they must show three things. One, they must demonstrate, first, that they are politically motivated violence, not greed violence like the drug cartel, politically motivated violence. Second, they must show severe and frequent hostilities against the United States. And third, they must have a secure, deep, extended command and control system. It's just not a couple guys sitting over here. It's not the mafia where they just say, I'm going to shoot you if you don't do what I say. But that's what drug cartels are. Their command and control is, I'll shoot you if you don't take these drugs, poor fishermen. And as far as severe hostilities, yes, they said that we suffer upwards of perhaps 80,000 or so deaths from overdoses and half. But we also suffer so many similar types of breath of deaths from car accidents made by foreign Toyota makers, car makers and all. And then, most important, they do not demonstrate politically motivated violence. Greed, yes. And so that's why people say they haven't, that designation does not meet the criteria of the law. When we operate on drug operations, which I've done with the Coast Guard, a law enforcement tat on us, we are permitted to fly off our helicopter and disable with a machine gun, so to speak, out of the helicopter, the rudder of one of these fast patrol boats. Not to hurt or anyone, just to disable them. And then the lead deck goes on and does the search, the seizure, the arrest. We've done that. And all of a sudden, after decades of doing this, to declare that they are actually in an armed conflict with us as narco-terrorists, criminal, yes, but narco-terrorists, means that you are changing decades of the interpretation of the law, placing your officers in that chain of command under moral and legal quandaries, because it is said in the Navy handbook for the law of naval operations, it is manifestly illegal to obey an order that you deem not legal. And so we are out there on the public commons of the seas. We're different than the Army. We're different than the Air Force. Everybody can be anywhere they want, even overflying you, when you are on the commons of the seas. And now all of a sudden to say, to place that commander out there in a tough situation when it's already challenging enough. Let me give you an example. In the 1980s, we shot down an Iranian Airbus with about 290 people, citizens of Iran, because as it was flying near the near a cruiser, they mistook it for a enemy aircraft of Iran. 2 years later, I'm going through the Straits of Hormuz. And all of a sudden, we pick up with our signals and radar, signals intelligence radar, that an warplane had taken off from Iran. And then it turned and came right through us as going through the narrow Straits of Hormuz with very little maneuver room. My crew was well trained, as every crew is. But this one, I had some exceptional sailors. We were ready, missiles ready, everything. And it was all my decision whether that plane was showing hostile intent or not. It's upon me because a mistake had been made 2 years earlier. That plane overflew us, the first Iranian aircraft ever to do so, a couple hundred feet. And we had to make that decision to now place an individual who has been trained, as we are, before we go to command, before we go to executive officer, to be the number two in command. Time and again, we are trained about obeying a lawful order as compared to an illegal one. And so this change in interpretation, without even providing the depth of any type of understanding of where is the political violence, places a quandary. And that's why I think you saw that the admiral who was in charge of the Southern Command resigned. And reportedly, the colonel, lawyer, we call them JAG, Judge Advocate Generals, also was pushed aside and ignored because there was a disagreement with whether these were legal orders. A background on this is that when the Secretary of Defense, Hegseth, took over, he fired the three top Judge Advocate Generals, that is, those who are in charge of each of the three services, the Navy, Marine as one, Air Force and Army's head lawyers. He said that now what we want to do is not have too broad an interference with rules of engagement. We want common sense. We don't want the wrong interpretation taken. He didn't say that last part. That's essentially though what he was saying. He closed down the Center of Civilian, it was the Center for Civilian Protection of Excellence, which we formed during Afghanistan, because we wanted to train and even become better at this global war of terror of not targeting innocent civilians. And so when you have this as background, wonderment begins to come out. And that's why I think you saw the Congress members who make the laws of the land actually say the words they did, that this is illegal. I will say this, though. I did not agree with one of the statements made that the service members must disobey an illegal order. It's fine to say, as I've written in op-ed and spoken about, that this is an illegal order, but they can get the same message without having a Congress member say you must. I had no problem with the statements of saying these are illegal orders. And frankly, I've written and I agree that they are. And so I think this is the challenge that we have, because as I began all this, we set up a world order based on universal values of democracy. And one of those is obeying, as the military has to do by the UCMJ, both national and international law. And breaking it, I think, is wrong.
Liberty, I know you're dying to say something, so go ahead.
I have multiple questions. First of all, do you think that it's possible that, you know, that entire operation was more coercive, like a sign of a show of force instead of actual useful intervention? And my other question for you is, how do you think... how do you think on a militaristic lens that the current balance of power between our checks and balances are being corrupted?
Within Washington, D.C., you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Congress.
Great. Both great questions. To the first one, we have a saying in the military, piss poor planning gives piss poor execution. So if this was a credible effort to try to interdict narco trafficking, the way they did it was so inept. I mean, the first five boats that they destroyed were all en route to the island that where 100% of the drugs are landed, 100% of them go to West Africa and Europe, not the United States. In fact, only 3% of all the drugs that come via the Caribbean come all the way through the Caribbean directly into America. The rest of it goes into Central America, comes across the border, or Mexico, and comes across the border. In fact, 100% of all fentanyl comes across the Mexican border. Hardly any of it goes on a ship anywhere. And almost all the cocaine, upwards of 80% of it, comes from the Pacific Ocean, not the Caribbean. So basically, they're putting their finger in a dike where there's a heck of a lot of big holes pouring through. And remember that almost all the fentanyl that comes across the border is carried by U.S. citizens because they aren't inspected like anyone who's not a U.S. citizen. And so down and out people go to Mexico, get like the poor fisherman does. And they've interviewed a couple of the families who lost these poor fishermen for $500 carrying the narco trafficker, carrying the drugs on those drug runner boats that were killed. They get about $500. And those coming across may get more for because the U.S. citizens don't know. But this is not any effective use of our military. Matter of fact, at the best that's ever been done by the U.S. Coast Guard at sea, maybe they interdict at most the full time something like 15%. Sometimes they might go a little higher to 20, 25%, but it's one of the most challenging things to do. The place to stop it is at the border. So that's number one. And on checks and balances, so I just don't think it's they're there to send a different message, I believe. And that again is to the president of Venezuela. But I don't understand what he's going to do next that potentially could not get us into a quagmire, except do a show of force by shooting something or someone inland or in territorial waters. To what impact is that? Unless he's just hoping Madeira leaves. But that country has been under some sort of a junta, some sort of a former military officer who's been in charge for decades. Don't think it's going to become democratic, I would think, automatically. It would take a lot more diplomacy to make that occur. As far as D.C., yes, I am concerned, as I think many Americans are, of the failure of the Congress in order to protect its constitutional duties. How can you impound money when it's against the law? And so you could go on several examples of that. There's certain conditions that possibly broke the posse comitatus law, using the posse comitatus, which is allowed by that law in L.A., that were quietly given to the National Guard there that said they could do. But if they had been issued in public until we found out about them, I think Congress should have said that goes against the law. This is not a posse comitatus situation. And as you probably know, posse comitatus was one that forbids the use of our military to enforce the domestic laws. But there is an exception to that. And one exception to that. And that's the Insurrection Act. And he hasn't used that yet that I'm aware of. But I do believe that even in this incident where the law many lawyers are saying this law is illegal of what we're doing in the Caribbean, have not spoken up as strongly as they have, although Rand Paul has.
Well, let me ask you.
I mean, Republicans, I'm talking here.
We often brag about the fact that we have the finest military fighting force in the world. And you've already addressed the fact that it's the rank and file sailors and soldiers that make that possible. So when you're attacking civilians, Admiral, what does that do to morale? Does that affect morale, you think, in our military?
I can't speak for the surety, except for what I experienced. I went on the ground in Afghanistan near the beginning of the war. Short mission, nothing extraordinary. I just basically had to meet up with SEALs and do some certain things over there. But when I was with them at the beginning of the war, near the beginning of the war, we were targeting any white Toyota truck with a laser and having an F-18 or whatever destroy it from above. Because we had intelligence that the Taliban had purchased a couple hundred of these white Toyota trucks. But farmers, I mean, if you go through Afghanistan, there's thousands of white Toyota vehicles. And what's to say the wife isn't in there? Or what's to say that it isn't just a farmer on that? SEALs brought in one night to camp, a couple people that and one of them, they're all, we laid some barbed wire around some trees and for the rest of the night. And one of them began banging his head against a tree. And I asked SEAL, so what gives? He says, Ali's the village idiot. We have to give $3,000 to any tribal chief that tells us this person's a Taliban or this person's an Al-Qaeda. I don't have a choice. I always wondered whether that fellow ended up in Gitmo. But I did report back in a meeting with Mr. Rumsfeld, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and he changed the law, how we were conducting it. Did it affect me? Yeah, darn right it did. I mean, we're not perfect by any means. We've had our My Lies massacre in Vietnam, as well as others. But by and large, we really do respect that law out there. And when we don't, I think it puts us and our national security at risk, because we attract allies and friends because of our adherence to law. And so that's why I do, there is reportedly, as articles have written as recently as today, that many people are concerned out there in the chain of command of what might happen if they follow these rules. I don't know that for a fact. I can only report what I read in the media. But I do think it would be concerning, and it would be to me out there.
Well, just knowing the kind of man that my brother was, I know he would have been concerned, and I could see that that would have an effect on our military, which again, I say, of the military people, and again, I can only speak from my experience, but the ones that I've met are particularly honorable people, and they care about the law, and they care about our country. Liberty, what else? Ask another brilliant question.
And Liberty, may I just say one thing, if I might?
Please, go ahead.
Well, the Senator Liberty had just brought up one other issue about what's it do to our military as a whole down there also, not just personnel. I wanted to point out that because we have, as you know, a nuclear submarine down there, and we have an amphibious ready group, and now we had a surface combatant group, and now they're joined by three more surface combatants and an aircraft carrier. That represents 15% of what, Liberty, I was speaking with you about a little earlier, are forward deployed forces. These are forces that are deployed outside the United States, not for an exercise, but to be there for presence, or in this case, Caribbean interdiction operations. Around the world, that's 15% of them. However, take the attack submarine fleet. We're down there not practicing, getting ready to do the type of warfare that has changed dramatically to where cyber warfare can actually close down our internet as it did in the largest war game that the Joint Chiefs of Staff held 2-3 years ago, because the Vice Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff said the Chinese had the capability to take down our internet by which we communicate. So it isn't just shooting kinetic weapons anymore. The new domain of warfare is cyberspace plus hypersonic missiles that the Chinese have upwards of 200 of, and we don't have one air radar that can detect them or missile to shoot them down. But today, 40% of the U.S. attack submarine fleet is out of commission for repairs. But we're idling one down there underwater to do what? And then you look at the amphibious ready groups that's down there. Only 41% of our entire amphibious fleet is ready for war today. The rest are in certain repairs, maintenance, not trained yet as they work up. Only 41%. The server fleet's a little bit better. It's about the mid-60s percent, but it has still a C. It's not in the D category or below. And so this is having an impact upon our overall readiness against which I had mentioned earlier with these we were chatting, which is with regard to deterring China and not letting it gain inroads. Because the difference today is, due to this intersection, this unique intersection we live in today, where advanced technology like cyberspace or AI intersects also with the economy, because with that submarine down there, it has 9,200 pounds of rare earth minerals off them, and it all comes from China. And it, those two, advanced technology, the economy, and geostrategy now intersect uniquely like they didn't in the Cold War. And because of that, every issue today is a national security issue. Heck, the cranes that are installed in L.A. port, by the we bought them from China, has software in them that actually has a modem in it that wasn't in the plan by which they could shut them down, as they've done to over 50 ports around the world to stop the flow of maritime. Warfare's changed because the Chinese, in my opinion, are bent upon a digital incarceration of the world so that they can follow Sun Tzu's warnings centuries ago that successful generals win, then they go to war. And if we're blind, deaf, and dumb for 4 or 5 or 6 days, that's all they need to hop onto Taiwan when it's only 120 kilometers away from China's mainland, and we're coming from San Diego. I'm sorry. Well, could you, quick question you still had then, please?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, if every issue is national security, that makes the question of cyberspace even more interesting, because in cyberspace, you know, actors can be anonymous, a lot of attacks could be deniable, and it seems like the battlefield is kind of everywhere. So in that case, how could you view, what does deterrence mean in the avenues of cyberspace?
And that is the key question, because let's take the day that Secretary Hegseth spoke to all the 4 and 3-star admirals in command and generals. They all came, as you remember, a few weeks ago for him to speak to. After he stretched physical standards and things like this, he then put out a memorandum that same day that said, we're going to decrease cybersecurity training. Now, mind you, the Defense Science Board of the Pentagon has said that all the servers on Aegis ships, or excuse me, Bloomberg News said that all the Aegis cruisers servers made in China have chips in them by which they could be closed down. The Navy, a couple years ago, did a study from outsiders, CEOs and others that really knew their business in cyber warfare and all. And they said to the Navy, you are building a fleet that's ideally prepared for a kinetic war of old. You are not building a fleet ready for the information war of the future. And so when 5G is laid down in Africa, AFRICOM, the general in charge of AFRICOM says, I can't use it because the Chinese built it and they're soaking everything in, so I can't use it for signals intelligence. Today, if 5G connected the world, 6G is going to rule the world. And the international ITU, I forgot what the T stands for, Union, China has dominated that. The United States isn't even playing in the game right now. This is, we set up that ITU. It's an international body to set up what the 6G standards are. And so what you have brought up is that this is a war that I'm extraordinarily, how do we deter against this when just a month ago, anybody who uses a company called F5, which is almost every agency, every cabinet agency in our government uses them, that an alert was put out that the Chinese state itself has infiltrated it and is going dormant in order for them to disrupt it at some time in the future, potentially during a crisis or conflict. Wow. They right now on this phone that you and I are on, they infiltrated last summer the FBI's ability to eavesdrop on anyone. And when they get, if they have a warrant, they infiltrated that system and they still don't know how they got in, and we haven't been able to get them out. That's the difference of the warfare domain. And we're down here with our carrier battle group that with our submarines only 40% not ready to go to war, and we're not practicing how to do cyber, et cetera. I visited the Naval Academy and spoke at it a few weeks ago. They have a wonderful cybersecurity training, the midshipmen, 80 of them who do NSA, National Security Agency, during the summer, the intern there. But only 30 were assigned cybersecurity duties when they during their when people the midshipmen chose their assignments, you know, air, surface, submarine, or cyber. Only 30 went cyber. Look, we cannot become like John Paul Jones, where you're blind and you're deaf, and therefore you can't fire your weapons until you see the white of their eyes. And I'm extraordinarily concerned about this. And this is a whole new domain, is this cyber warfare.
Mm. Well, and do we really need to worry about all this when our head of the Department of War puts our battle plans out on cyber chat? I mean, it's just crazy, isn't it? But yes, I think that the things you're saying, Admiral, should be an alert to all of us that we really need to readjust our thinking about how we fight in the future.
But
let me ask you some.
I thank you for this opportunity, because you, or I can't remember which one of you two brought it up. Maybe it was you, Liberty. I really feel that once again, to the fore, like it was during the 50s and 60s, speaking about national security in its new ethos, how it really is today, and how dependent we are that our allies don't sell chips from the Netherlands, because they make about the third best chips, and we convinced them, even though they didn't want to initially, not to sell them to China. But yet today, when we're beating down on our allies, why should they say, whoa, it's not good to punch down? And why should they be with us? And that's why I hope we have more of this kind of discussion about the change that's occurring. There is a new world order trying to arise, and even wants to have not the dollar any longer be the means by which people trade, which would mean that we don't become the safe haven for the dollar anymore, which means that we have real problems with the ability to have a large debt like we do today.
Well, I'm sure that was Liberty, because I'm the color announcer. You know, she's the real substance of the show. I'm just here to make everybody laugh a little bit. But let me ask you, with all this that's going on, I want to move on a little bit because of your vast experience in world and international politics. What about what's going on in Gaza? Do you think that the peace plan that's been put forth, is that anything that's really going to take over there? It looks like they put this plan in place. Now they've already moved on to Ukraine. They're going to tell Ukraine that by Thanksgiving they need to surrender, basically, or the U.S. is going to pull out. How is this foreign policy? I just don't get it.
First, let me two sentences or so on Ukraine. I think what this plan is reported to be is the worst possible thing that we need for our national security with Ukraine. Look, I felt President Biden was slow in providing them the armament they needed early on. I mean, to give them tanks right away as they wanted them, we're not going to use tanks against China. To give them the armored cavalry vehicles right away, we're not going to use them against China. It's an Air Force Navy war primarily. And not to give them Patriot missiles to protect themselves, we were slow. And that wasn't right. Because they were fighting for their freedom much like we did. And it was only because of the French, who stayed with us for 4 years. And General Rauschenbaum convinced George Washington, who was reluctant, to march to Yorktown. And there, because he realized the French was a better warfighter, he gave command of American armies to be combined with the French soldiers there and won our independence. Today, it's not an American whose sculpture is closest to the White House. It's a General Rauschenbaum, because an ally gave us our freedom. I think we owe that protection again with Ukraine, because we forced them to give up the nuclear weapon. And Russia signed an agreement. If they did that, they would never attack them. And they broke that commitment. Second, on Gaza. Once President Biden said, Israel is over the top, and then did nothing, he permitted the word of a president to become ordinary, which it never should be. It might be here in America, but overseas, when a president speaks and then doesn't act, it says a lot about whether his word is good. I believe that we have hurt our national security by permitting what occurred to continue on. As I told you, we did. I understand Israel. I would defend them every part of the way. In fact, I took my cruiser, and when I was going off to the wars and then did the precursor ops, combat ops against Iraq, I left my cruiser there and entwined it into the air defense zone to protect them. Man, I backpacked to China my first week for 2 weeks. I still have my shirt, Never Again Masada. I bought my wife's diamond ring there. And the ambassador from Israel asked me when I was in Congress, over for the first night of Hanukkah with his wife. But there was another person in the room, the head of their Navy, who asked me if I could get them access to the littoral combat ship we were just beginning to build, and the Navy was refusing, and I did it. And then that Arrow missile you heard so much about, that shot down those ballistic missiles and all, had sent the head of the ballistic missile defense system over to us and asked me if I could move them, get them not to, the United States company was getting an authorization bill that it would have to be the Aegis missile, not the Arrow, if I could change it. I said, I can delay it by a study, giving you time to change it. No, I'll defend them to the day, every day. I would have died for that country. But our universal values did not permit us to allow them the indiscriminate kind of targeting that they were doing. And I think we've hurt our national security of that. This plan, I just don't understand how it's going to be brought about. If peace can be brought about, fine. But I honestly believe that it has to be with a solid two-state solution, just like we signed up to with international law. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that in the offering, in the outlines of this plan yet.
I agree. Well, I can't let Liberty ask any more questions because he's really showing me up, as usual. So let me ask you, is there something, we're about to end very shortly, Admiral, is there something that you want to say that we haven't asked you?
Well, I think that, let me just talk about one thing, if I might.
Yeah, please.
I talked about our enlisted. Twice it was a young enlisted man who stood up and helped me not feel into harm's way. But the reason they're so good compared to like Russia's is because they come in, and when the F-14 that Tom Cruise is flying gets retired, we retrain them. So when he comes back on the F-18, we don't throw him out like when a coal mine closes down. We actually retrain them. They get training and education for a lifetime. And I think that we have neglected that in America. For the 65% of Americans that don't have a college degree, you go out there to Iowa like I was, and you see that the tractors are becoming autonomous. And what's happening to those drivers? We put less into training and retraining than any of the 38 richest countries in the world, those that belong to the OECD nation, half the kids between 18 and 22 in Germany are in apprenticeship. We need to stand up to that issue, because it'll be immensely needed in the new AI area and welding and all that needs to be done. And then I'll end with the final story, if you don't mind.
No.
Sometimes people ask me about what's most important that you learned in the military. And I think is most lacking, as I mentioned, when presidents speak and then they don't follow up, or it's an unclear mission. And it's gone on too long. And that's the lack of accountability. Because when you're not accountable for your word by doing your mission, then this nation loses trust in its political leaders. So come aboard with me just for a moment on that aircraft carrier that you had brought up, Senator, that I commanded, the George Washington Carrier Battle Group. Those first few nights when we got off Afghanistan, I wanted those strikes to go well. And so we put up, just kind of set the tone for the campaign for us. And so we put up in the first couple flights what we call pros from Dover. Those had been in the first Gulf War. Those guys were immensely trained. And then we started funneling in what we call nuggets. That is, someone who's not been off a carrier deck over a foreign country before, a brand new pilot. And one of them, in one of the first couple flights, was a young 26-year-old woman pilot who disobeyed the orders I had passed down that evening. You see, we knew the Taliban, who had once been called the Mujahideen, but now rebranded themselves, had Stinger missiles that went to about 18,000. So the orders I had passed down came down from above me, but I passed them down and said, no one goes below 20,000 feet unless you ask permission. Because we wanted time to move an asset. We didn't have a lot of them up there, an asset over that could provide them special protection electronically and other means as those pilots went down against potentially Stinger missiles that were meant to be a ground-to-air missile, portable, carried by the Taliban. But that night, about 0200 in the morning, 8 Special Forces were ambushed. 4 died immediately, Senator. The other 4 called up and said, we have moments left. Someone just strafed nearby quickly. They're too close to use laser guide munitions. Someone just dive and strafe. We'll get the hell out of here in the noise. All the men asked permission. That young woman pilot didn't think there was time, brand new, to ask permission and wait for that aircraft. She dove 3 times in the middle of that night, and in that havoc she created, those 4 men picked up their dead comrades and came home, and certainly wouldn't have, I don't think, if she hadn't been there. she was going to be accountable for her mission, ready to risk her service career, if not her life, for doing the right thing for her mission. I'll never forget that night. It was a tall standard for me, I think, as I went forward to continue to try to stand up to. That accountability is what most matters. And when you change the interpretation of a law that decades were trained on, that to me loses the trust that that woman certainly would have for me any day for what she did. But I can't be trusted when someone changes the law and an interpretation not and put our men and women in a moral and legal hazard way. So thanks for having me aboard tonight.
Yeah, and that's a powerful way to end it. And let me tell you that normally we play a song in honor of our guests, and there's so many that we could play for you. But tonight, I'm going to take a moment of personal privilege. Admiral, you and I have a friend named Paul Harrison, who's in hospice right now. Yep. And, you know, Thanksgiving is coming up, and we have a tradition in my family that everybody goes around and says what they're thankful for. And some of the things that I'm thankful for are men like Admiral Sestak, who put their country and the safety of our nation before their own personal safety. I'm also thankful for young, amazing people like Liberty Jones, who are going to change the world someday. But I'm also thankful for people like Paul Harrison. Paul is one of those volunteers who's behind the scenes that does the legwork for all of us. So I'm going to ask every listener that's out there, and I'm sure you don't mind this, Admiral, to close out this way, that when you say your prayer at Thanksgiving, say a prayer for Paul, because he really is the kind of American that Admiral Sestak has been talking about tonight. The kind of America that makes us great. So we're going to leave you tonight with a song by Josh Groban, "You Raise Me Up." Thank you, Admiral. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Liberty. I'm thankful for all of you.
Well done. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Liberty.